Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, growing, foraging, and catching our food. Washington Post columnist Tamar Hespel and her husband move from Manhattan to 2 acres on Cape Cod. They decide to adopt a more active approach to their diet, raising chickens, growing tomatoes, even foraging for mushrooms, and hunting their own meat. Her book is To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. Welcome, Tamar. Nice to see you.
Hi, Mindy. Nice to know what you look like. Since we're on Zoom, you're not just a voice.
So take us back to the roots of this idea to grow some of your own food. You were still in Manhattan at this point.
When we lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, that's where I lived when I met my husband, and that's where we lived together. And I had never grown anything to eat. I had never foraged a mushroom. I had never caught a fish. But actually, my husband was the impetus behind this. And one day he said, do you think we could put a vegetable garden on the roof of the building? And I had no idea. And it surprised me when I asked the building manager, hey, could we put a garden in some whiskey barrels on the roof? And she had no problem with it. And she said, yeah, sure, go ahead. And that was the beginning of this adventure, really, because I had to be talked into this. But it was my first sense of what it was like to actually grow your own tomato. Now, have you grown your own tomatoes?
Oh, I have. Yeah, it's like magic, isn't it? It's like,
whoa. It is. It's like magic. And you will swear, I mean, not in a court of law, but you will swear between you and me that they're the best tomatoes that ever existed, the ones that you grow yourself.
Right. Because they are.
Thank you. And so we grew these little cherry tomatoes, and it was sort of revelatory because, of course, they were delicious. But it was my first foray into eating and serving my family food that I was invested in, that I had gotten my hands dirty in service of. And so we expanded the garden. So the building had these skylights, and it had with grates over them, and we used them as cucumber trellises, and the cucumbers crawled up over the grate. And I was worried because I said to Kevin, my husband, I mean, what if people see this and then everybody wants to do it? It'll put the kibosh on the whole thing. And Kevin said, honey, people in this building don't even cook their own food. They're not going to grow their own food. Right. And it's true that people were interested, but nobody else wanted to do it. And then we moved to Cape Cod, and our horizons really expanded because, of course, you can do all kinds of things on Cape Cod that you can't do on a rooftop in New York.
Right. So you move, you have a couple of acres and you think, okay, we're going to do this. But you learn pretty quickly that Cape Cod soil is not the best for gardens.
It's sand. It's basically sand. And so we have a few things going against us. First, we have the sand. But also our property is mostly sloped. And so there are very few flat places that we can put things so that if you try and amend the soil, it doesn't just run down the hill. And then on top of that, we got lots of trees. And so there's a lot of shade, which is a great thing in August because our house stays nice and cool. But it's not so great for the garden. And you'd really hate to cut down trees. Yeah. And so we found a couple spots, and, you know, we'll call it still a decade in, a work in progress.
Well, it's interesting. I am a gardener, so, you know, it's reading long. But I found a brilliant tip from your husband here. You, like many folks, were looking for materials to build a cold frame. And you're in Home Depot, and your husband comes up with this brilliant idea that I am totally stealing. Tell us about that.
I am so glad. So we built this a cold frame the old-fashioned way. So, you know, we had some lumber, and then we stole a glass door from the dump, which is, of course, what everybody does. And so we built this whole big cold frame, but we needed more space because I think we were a little overambitious in our seed starts that year. And so we're in Home Depot, and Kevin's looking around, and he says, I have an idea. And usually I quake in my boots when Kevin says, I have an idea. But in this case, we went over to the aisle where they have, people have probably seen when you have like a cellar level window, they make these semicircular vent covers that go over them. They're plastic, and they're probably about 3 feet long. And Kevin took two of those, put them back to back, and then he went to the clip aisle and he got clips and he clipped them together, and voila, we had a circular 3 foot cold frame that is completely movable, and we've been using it ever since.
So then what to plant is always a big question. And you write, perennial vegetables, though, are nature's cruel joke. She tantalizes you with the idea of automatic food and then delivers almost nothing to eat. And I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, the only perennials, I have strawberries and asparagus. But right, I mean, rhubarb.
So, so there are a couple of vegetables that the perennial, I need, like, the axis of deliciousness is asparagus, artichokes, and rhubarb. Those are the three perennial vegetables that people mostly have. But we wanted, you know, a standard issue salad green. And, you know, really, is that too much to ask? And so we looked at, you know, we read up on permaculture, which is what people call agriculture using perennials. And we narrowed this list down to two, Turkish rocket and Good King Henry. And we planted those, and I was very excited about them. But they taste terrible. And your first clue should be that one of them, Good King Henry, I think, that its nickname is poor man's spinach. Never go for a plant that's poor man's anything, because that's just an indication that it's a pale imitation of the plant you actually want to eat. And so I will say that we still have Turkish rocket and Good King Henry. They come up every year. They are very hardy. But these are basically wild plants. And wild plants have to defend themselves. And so, you know, it's being delicious is not in their best interest. Being woody or hairy or poisonous, that's in their best interest. Yeah. So of course that's what they are. So that's why it's very difficult to find perennial plants that are bona fide delicious. And anyone who tells you purslane is delicious is blowing smoke.
I have a lot of purslane in my yard.
Tastes like grass clippings.
Well, so you know, you're doing really well. You're experimenting and you've got the garden going. Then you go, what else can we do? And you decide to grow mushrooms. Something I have never thought of, because I thought it would just be too difficult, right? But I'm inspired here again. You not so shiitakes. Go with the shiitakes, right?
Go with the shiitakes. So, first I want to talk about one thing you said, which is, like, you thought it would be too difficult. So the whole theme of the book is basically, it's really not too difficult.
No,
the
right.
whole theme of the book is that none of this is rocket science. Human beings have been procuring their food, you know, since the dawn of human beings. And, you know, it's in our DNA to be able to do this. And so, like, if you want to try something, the absolute best thing you can do is try it. And okay, you can warm up with a couple of YouTube videos, but basically there's nothing in the food world that ordinary people can't just go out and try to do. And that was one of the most gratifying things. And now, shiitakes, yeah. I digress. And shiitakes ended up being terrific for, like, sort of the opposite reason that, you know, it sounds like it could be complicated or it sounds like it could be difficult, but it's actually dead simple. It takes one afternoon's work. You have to procure some hardwood logs that are freshly cut. And, you know, since we live on 2 acres of, you know, trees, which are the building blocks of logs, we didn't have any problem getting our logs, because we had a tree that needed felling anyway. But landscapers or arborists will be able to help you get hold of logs. And you need a power drill, and you need to order those little dowels that are inoculated with shiitake spawn from a mushroom provider. And we get ours from an outfit called Fungi Perfecti. And then you have to recruit your friends, because it is the first, that one afternoon is a big job where you drill a million little holes in these logs and you pound home a dowel in each hole, and then you cover it with a little melted wax so nothing else can get in. and then you wait. But the good news is that once you do that part, you don't have to do anything ever again. You just get your mushrooms, and they can fruit. Mm. Our first batch of mushroom logs fruited for a good 5 years. Wow. you can even force them, because a rain will trigger a flush. And so you'll get a big flush after a storm, but you can simulate that by, you know, soaking them in a tub, or we happen to live on a pond. We soak them in the pond for a couple of days, and then we get this big flush right on schedule.
Yeah, sounds great. All right, tell us about the Jake principle.
So the Jake principle is named after my late little brother, who one day walked into my parents' apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Now, my parents didn't have any outdoor space, but they did have a fireplace. And my father really liked to grill fish, and he was very good at it, actually. And so my parents had this little hibachi that they put in the fireplace, and they would grill fish on the hibachi. And I will say that my dad turned out a mean halibut steak. And one day my little brother walked in to the house, and he saw this, and he said, "Mom, if that was okay to do, wouldn't other people do it?" And as Kevin and I ventured into all of these attempts to procure food in ways that we had never done before, of course, you automatically start thinking of other ways to do things, solutions that might or might not work. And there were a surprising number of times where I said to myself, you know, if this was okay to do, wouldn't other people do it? And usually the answer is, if other people don't do it, there's a really good reason. And so it is with perennial greens. If good King Henry was delicious, everybody's yard would be covered with it. And every now and then, you know, the thing that nobody else does is this iconoclastic thing of genius. But really, most of the time, it's you not learning from other people's mistakes.
Right. Something that learned there for sure. We're talking with Tamara Haspel. Her book is To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Tamara Haspel about her book, To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You know, I found lots of inspiration in this book.
and they, you know, check it. You couldn't tell me a better thing, because as a writer, it feels like such hubris to think, oh, I want to inspire people. And if somebody says they're inspired, it's like the single best thing you can tell me.
All right, so you write in the book, chickens are a first-hand food Rubicon. Gardening, which we were doing with a vengeance, is mainstream, and nobody will look at you twice as long as you're growing standard issue backyard produce like kale and tomatoes and not, say, sugar cane and sorghum. But as soon as you get chickens, you're serious.
Yes, you are. And it's like, so somebody I talked to about the book said that he was surprised because he looked at the title and he looked at the premise and he thought this was what he called a granola book. And we all know what that means, the crunchy granola. Like, and once you get chickens, I don't care. You can tell me that, you know, you don't even like crunchy granola and you've never owned a pair of Birkenstocks, but you will still be in that group. But backyard chickens are one of the best things to do to get yourself familiar with number one, how satisfying it is to raise your own food. But number two, how jumping into something that you've never done before. And most people, when they get backyard chickens, have never designed a chicken coop. They've never built a chicken coop. They've never selected the chickens that are the right breeds. They've never, you know, put little chicks in a brooder. And all of those things are firsts for most people. They certainly were for me. And this is sort of where I discovered the secret to successful self-improvement. Because you can try and try and try to be better at the things that are central to you. For me, I'm a writer. I try really hard to be a better writer, but it's hard to improve at something that you've already done for decades. But it's easy to improve at something you've never done before. And the great thing about all of these enterprises is that you spend your time on the steep part of the learning curve, and that's satisfying, and it's strength building, because you feel like you're acquiring not just eggs, but skills.
Yeah, and chickens are a lot more interesting than you might think. I think in the book you talk about Kevin sitting out there in his lawn chair kind of watching the chicken show. Yeah,
he did. And they do put on a show. And, you know, it's so funny because you say chickens are really interesting. We enjoy watching them. And then people say, well, what do they do? And you're like, well, they peck at your shoes.
Yeah. They have personality.
Some of them actually do have personality. We had one chicken that we named George because she was curious. And for a while, we were able to let our chickens free range. At one point, foxes moved into our neighborhood, so we weren't able to do that anymore. But if you left a car door open, she would go in your car. She would check it out. Whatever we were doing, she would come around. She had a little bit of a dog quality to her, George did. They don't all have personalities, but you'll find some that do. And it's kind of great to know them as individuals.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess choosing the right chicken, and you've got a whole section here, chicken basics, that, you know, check out the rules, you know, the laws in your neighborhood, all of that. But one of the things in there, another little tidbit I learned, you talk about the chickens when they were, you know, roaming the yard in the morning, they're like very noisy. Let us out. We want to roam. And the ones that you have just kept in the run that didn't go out, don't. Like they're fine. They're not squawking at you. And yeah. I asked my neighbor has chickens, and I said, "Is that true?" She goes, "Oh yeah, absolutely. If they haven't been out, they're fine to be in the run."
They have three brain cells and short memories, and so, and you know, it's funny because in my day job, I'm a columnist at the Washington Post, and I write, among other things, about our food system. And I write about animal welfare. And, you know, one of the reasons we do all of these things is because my husband and I do opt out of a lot of the conventional meat available in our system because I don't like the way that the animals are treated. And so I spent a whole lot of time trying to figure out, okay, well, what makes a chicken happy? And it's hard to tell. But I think if you spend time with them, you do begin to get an inkling. And it did surprise me that, yeah, if they're used to going out, oh, they want to go out. And if you don't let them out, they're like, what the fuck? Free range. But if they've never been out, they don't make a break for it.
Yeah, exactly. And then talking about humane treatment of animals, you talk a lot about that in the way that they're killed, right? And that is another learning experience for you. You had never killed a chicken before.
I had never killed anything before except, you know, this stray mosquito. And this was something that was extremely hard for me. And, you know, I had a lifetime of rooting for the gazelles on Wild Kingdom. And the idea that I would kill an animal that I was going to eat was really difficult for me to sort of step up to. But, you know, I have been a meat eater, and I decided that the single best way for me to guarantee that the animal that I'm eating had a good life and a humane, which is quick and relatively pain-free death, is to do it myself. And so I decided I wasn't going to be a coward about it, because it was really only cowardice that stood between me and doing it. And in the book, I write about our first flock of turkeys and how we, you know, did all of our research and figured out how, what we thought was the best way to slaughter them, which is what we still do. And I had a knife, my kitchen knife, that I sharpened to within an inch of its life. And we put this turkey upside down in the cone and just a light cut across its neck so that you sever the blood vessels, but not the trachea or the esophagus, and the bird bleeds out. and it was really hard. But its being hard was what made it satisfying. And, you know, I know that there are lots of people out there who don't eat meat or who do eat meat and don't want to come face to face with the animals anyway. And I totally get that. But I've had really interesting responses from people who are vegetarian or vegan, who don't shy away, who say, you know, I'm vegetarian or vegan because I don't like the way we raise animals in this country, but I really respect what you're doing. And so that has been one of the most horizon widening experiences that I've undertaken.
Yeah. And you mentioned the turkeys. That was a total impulse buy. I mean, you weren't planning on getting turkeys. Well, we got chickens. How hard could it be, right?
And, you know, as impulse buys go, livestock, really not good. But that, you're exactly right. It was like, okay, well, we did chickens. We figured that out. So presumably we can figure this out. And when we got the turkeys, they were really small. So we figured, okay, well, we'll put them in a brooder until we figure out what else to do. And our first effort at turkey housing was a little bit of a disaster. It took us a while to get it right. But eventually we did figure it out. It was another lesson in the importance of firsts. You learn so much more the first iteration of any new thing than you do of any subsequent iterations. And it was another example of winging it, taking a flyer, trying something that you've never done before. And that's kind of, you know, it's one of the themes of the book about, you know, what that does to you, because I found that it builds you up. It rounds you out. It's a good thing.
Yeah. We're talking with Tamara Haspel. Her book is To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so your next adventure into something else you hadn't done before, but your husband had, is fishing.
Fishing. And so I had one experience fishing when I was a kid. My family used to spend summer vacations on Cape Cod, which is our original connection here. And we got a little cottage on a lake that's very much like the lake I live on now. And my family never fished, but we had next door neighbors and the father fished. And so he took me and my friend out fishing on Peter's Pond. And I remember it's being hot. I remember it's taking a long time. I remember it's being really boring. And I remember catching no fish at all. And when I talk to people and I ask, do you like to fish? And they say, no, not really. And my next question is always, have you caught a fish? Because fishing is boring, but catching is wildly exciting. And so the key to successful fishing is definitely catching. And the people who tell you that, no, it's nice to be out on a boat and on a nice day fishing regardless, this is nonsense. Fishing is only good when you catch fish. And fortunately, my husband had fishing skills, but fishing is hyper-local, as anyone will tell you. And so it took us a while to sort of get the feel for some of the fisheries around here. And you know, we had a lot of people who didn't help us and a bunch of people who really did. And I don't know, that was one of the themes of what kept happening to us. When you try something new, you reach into your community and you connect with other people who are doing it. We joined the Cape Cod Organic Gardeners. We joined the Osterville Anglers Club. And having this activity in common connects us to people that I don't think we otherwise ever would have met. And it can be people who aren't like you at all, because the point of intersection is this one thing: you fish or you garden or you hunt. And so it's a diverse group. And I don't want to go all full out kumbaya on you or anything, but getting food is this human universal. And I think it does have the power to connect us at a time when we seem to be pretty divided.
You write in the book, one of the best things about firsthand food is that it doesn't break the bank. You can forage right out your back door with nothing but enthusiasm. You can start a garden on a shoestring. With a few tools and some ingenuity, you can build a chicken coop that eggs will pay for. Fishing is the exception at first. If you have a nearby shoreline and some good advice, you can catch enough fish to justify some secondhand fishing gear. But once fishing takes hold of you, boats and trucks are involved, and that's when the spending starts. And I love the conversation about what kind of a boat you need. You know, you had a different idea than Kevin, and Kevin wanted a little bit bigger boat than you wanted.
Oh, my God. It was so funny. Excuse me. Because we decided we were going to buy a boat. And this was at a time when, you know, we didn't really know where our next dime was coming from. Both of us had careers that the internet had sort of pulled the rug out from under. And we came to Cape Cod with some resources, but we didn't know what our financial future was going to look like. And so it was a big step for me to say, okay, yeah, let's buy a boat. So we talked about it. And we said, okay, well, we'll buy just a small boat, center console, 15 to 17 feet, easily trailerable. And, you know, 15 to 17 with me leaning toward 15 and Kevin leaning toward 19. and so we looked around and we found this boat. It was a really basic boat. We don't have it anymore. It was a 19, I can talk about this on Cape Cod. It's a 19-foot Eastern center console with a 90-horse Johnson motor. It was not new. And when we went to look at it, of course, boats always look much bigger on land than they do in the water. And so we went to look at it, and I'm like, this is the Queen Mary. We can't buy this boat. And Kevin is constantly reminding me of that, by the way. He will not let me forget that I said that. And so, but one of the other ways we navigate marriage is that, you know, the person who cares most gets to make the decision. And not only did Kevin care the most, he knew the most about boats. The lion's share of the maintenance was going to fall to him. And so I thought that this was basically Kevin's decision to make. So we bought this boat, we took it home, and we launched it in Prince Cove, which is right here on the south side of Cape Cod. There's three bays, East Bay, West Bay, East Bay, Catoosa Bay, West Bay, Catoosa Bay, North Bay. And so we put it in at Prince Cove. And in the bays, of course, it's quite calm. And so we're tooling around in this boat, and I'm thinking, wow, it's awfully spacious. and then Kevin takes it out the cut where Samson Island comes on Kituit. And all of a sudden we're in Nantucket Sound. And anyone who has boated in Nantucket Sound understands the difference between Nantucket Sound and the embayments. And all of a sudden, I mean, it's not like it was a tremendously windy day, but they're 2-foot waves. And I've never been on a boat in 2-foot waves. And I'm trying really hard not to be a coward about it. But, you know, the slam of a hull coming off of a wave is a scary thing if you've never experienced it before. And so Kevin's behind me. He's driving the boat. I'm sitting on the seat in front of the console, you know, white knuckled, gripped on the thing. And I hear him say something. And I can't hear what it is. So I turn around and Kevin says, "You still want a smaller boat?" And I'm like, no, honey, I don't want a smaller boat. And he starts laughing. He thinks this is the funniest thing he's ever done to scare the bejesus out of his wife. So we did get that boat, and I did learn to fish on that boat. And we have since had a couple of iterations. And yeah, as we speak, there's a 26-foot Shamrock Mackinaw in our driveway.
Yeah. So not only did you learn to fish, and you talk about the different types of fishing that you do, you know, for the striped bass and the bluefish and whatever, but you also got pretty good at filleting fish, any type of fish.
It's so funny because I from the very first fish I caught, I wanted to fillet it myself and I wanted to fillet it well. And for a while, it took me a long time to sort of articulate why I care so much, because, you know, a botched filet tastes just as good as a perfect filet. But there's something about processing an animal with care that that re-emphasizes the idea that this is important. When you take the life of an animal, you have to do it as best you can, and you have to not waste any part of that animal. Yeah. And so I am very anal about how we take care of fish, that they go in a saltwater slurry right away. We cool them down. And I fillet them as well as I possibly can. And yeah, I got good at it. And, you know, so many of these skills are just a matter of practice.
Yeah. So do you have a favorite fish that you like to fish for?
Yeah, I do. I really like fishing for bluefish. I like fishing for bluefish because they're everywhere. They're easy to find. Last I checked, they weren't overfished. And boy, do they fight. And the kind of fishing that we do, we take the boat out to one of the shoals in Nantucket Sound and we troll for them. And when you hit them, you can, you know, hit them over and over and over again. And there have been many times when we've been out there, when we've been out there and we've taken home our limit, which has been wonderful. And we will eat one of them for dinner. And I make a mean black and blue fish sandwich, Mindy, I will tell you. And any of the ones that we don't eat that day will smoke. So, but a lot of people are like, ew, bluefish. Do you like bluefish?
I do not.
Okay. Well, then
I have had bluefish pate that I've liked, but yeah, and generally not. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to throw down the gauntlet here. And if our paths can ever cross in person and not just on the radio, I'm going to make you a black and blue fish sandwich that will change your mind about bluefish.
All right. I'm willing to give it a try. We're talking with Tamara Haspel. Her book is To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Tamara Haspel. Her book is To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Alan is giving us a call from Sandwich. Hi, Alan.
Hello there. How are you?
Great.
Good.
Yeah,
I'd like to speak a little bit about a perennial salad green. When I was growing up in Queens, New York, when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, we lived near a small park, about 5 acres or so. And in the early spring, there would be maybe 10 people grazing in this park, picking dandelions. And dandelions are really very good in salads. Now, most people don't grow dandelions on purpose, but they are really good in a salad. And they are perennial.
You've made dandelion wine.
Alan, I'm so glad you brought up dandelions because you're right. Dandelion greens are pretty good, and they're one of the best wild greens going. Have you ever made dandelion wine?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, this is your next challenge because it's quite an experience. This is another thing that we did that was like a first, because I figured, okay, well, we got the greens. And I had my copy of Yule Gibbons Stalking the Wild Asparagus. And so we tried to make the wine as well. And the wine also delivers. So I would say dandelions are one of the great underrated plants growing out there. So I'm really glad you brought them up.
Yeah, Alan, thank you for the phone call. You have to talk about the salt experiment because, as you said, everybody asks you about this, right? And it's
crazy.
Yeah, go ahead.
So we have this little tiny house and we have a wood stove. And like everybody else on the planet, when you heat with wood, you have one of these cast iron pots with a little lattice top, and you put water on it, on the top of the stove to humidify the house because it's a very dry heat. So we're sitting around in the dead of winter, and the wood stove was cranked up, and I could see the little tendrils of steam coming off it. And I said to Kevin, what would happen if we put seawater in there? And Kevin was like, well, honey, it would evaporate. And I said, well, wouldn't we be left with sea salt? And he says, probably a tablespoon or two. But that got me thinking. And so we looked up, you know, what percent of water is salt? If I have 5 gallons of water, how much salt am I going to get? And so we decided to give this a shot. So I put on my waders and we went out to Sandy Neck with a giant pot. And I was really glad it was a cold day, because here I'm wading into the water with this giant pot. And there was like 3-foot waves coming in. And if you've ever tried to fill a pot with seawater in 3-foot waves, you know it's harder than it sounds. So I finally fill this pot with water and we put it in the back of the truck and we start putting it in our dehumidifier. And, you know, because I'm actually decent at math, I'm calculating, okay, how much of the water has to evaporate before the salt starts precipitating out? We all remember this from junior high school chemistry. I'm like, okay, well, it has to reduce to about a tenth of its volume. And so we keep filling, it evaporates, filling, evaporates. And then it gets down to like a tenth of its volume. And we're standing over this thing fascinated. And, you know, this is evaporation. It's exactly the same process by which paint dries. And it should be equally exciting. But we're like waiting for the first salt crystals to make themselves known. And finally, we get a little skim on the surface and we're like, salt, salt. And it eventually all the water boils off and we were left with this pure white sea salt. It was astonishing. And it was so funny because it was entirely predictable. We knew exactly how much salt we would get. But when it happened, it was still kind of crazy interesting. Exciting. And yeah, it was funny because I did a speaking gig a little while after that. And the woman was like, Tamar, I know you do all this thing, you fish, you hunt, you garden, but make sure to tell us about the salt. I'm like, you want to hear about the salt? They're like, yeah, we want to hear about the salt.
That's so funny. All right. So another, you were feeding acorns to your pigs when you started thinking about human consumption of acorns.
Yep.
A bit of a process.
It is a bit of a process. But it was embarrassing because, you know, I knew acorns were nuts and I knew that nuts were food, but I never connected the dots that acorns would actually be food for humans until I saw how much my pigs liked them. And at this point, we were trying not just to eat. We had this project going where we were trying to eat at least one food we got firsthand every day, but I was trying to make it a substantial part of our diet. And nuts, of course, do that. They're nutritious food. They're high in calories. They're a staple. And we had a whole garbage can full. So I'm like, all right, well, let's give this a shot. But the problem with acorns, if you've ever picked one up and actually tasted one, they're incredibly tannic. And so although people have been eating acorns since this continent was populated by indigenous people, you do have to process them. And the way you process them is by multiple changes of water. And you can do it you can boil water to do it, and then it's fewer changes of water, or you can do it in cold water. And I didn't want to use all that energy to boil all that water. But if you're doing it in cold water, you have to change the water several times a day, and it can take a week to do it. Luckily, we all have in our homes an appliance that will do that for you. And I said to Kevin, I'm going to put these in a laundry bag and I'm going to put them in the toilet tank, because that the water, you know, every time you flush, it refills. You change the water. And Kevin's like, ew. I'm like, no, it's fine. Because like everything icky that happens in a toilet happens downstream from the tank. The water that fills your tank is the same water, you know, that you take, that you shower in. And so I took this bag of acorns and I put it in the toilet tank. And at first the water would turn just a little bit brown, and then eventually it ran clear. And so that's how I took the tannins out of the acorns. And then I was looking around for a recipe for acorn flour. And there were really two kinds of recipes. One that was, it was all acorn flour, which really sounded like it would be awful. And one where there was so little acorn flour in it, that it would barely even qualify. But I found a recipe that was a happy medium. And we made these flatbreads out of the acorn flour. And they were fine. I would say they were even tasty. But they weren't tasty enough for us to ever do that again, because it was an awful lot of work.
But it's worth trying, right? And I
it is absolutely worth trying.
Yeah, you're right. I'm increasingly convinced that in all kinds of experimentation, low expectations are your friend. If you go in thinking you're going to impress Gordon Ramsay, it will all end in tears. But if you go in thinking that your pigs are going to love this, there's nowhere to go but up. I love that. I want to get into the whole hunting thing here, because you have a fear of guns. But despite your fear of guns, you took up deer hunting.
I did. And again, you know, like the turkeys, this was really difficult for me. I didn't grow up with guns. I don't like guns. I still don't like guns. But I decided that, you know, okay, in for a penny, in for a pound. And I do think that one of the most responsible ways that we can eat meat is by eating overpopulated species that are causing ecological damage. So deer and, you know, wild pigs and Canada geese and things like that. And I don't like to be the kind of person who doesn't do something just because, even though she believes it's a good idea, it's scary or distasteful in some way. And so for my 47th birthday, I got a shotgun and also a crew cut, but that's not really part of the story. And so Massachusetts is a shotgun state. You can't use rifles. And that started our 4-year quest to shoot a deer. And it did take 4 years, and I did have to venture out of Massachusetts. And, you know, here on Cape Cod, we have deer, but there's like 20,000 hunters pursuing all 7 of them. And so I don't stand a chance compared to the people who have been hunting here their whole lives and know how to do it. And so it took us through many states and 4 seasons before we went to Virginia to a friend's house who has a property that's basically a sardine can full of deer. You can practically shoot at random and get one. And in the book, I do tell the story of the first deer that I shot, which was very small. It was a button buck. But my idea about this is that I'm not in it for a trophy. And my primary concern is that I shoot this animal cleanly and I minimize the suffering. And so I had a shot at a very small deer and I took it. And I'm happy to say that it dropped with one shot, as have every deer that I've shot since. And which doesn't mean I'm not a marksman. With all you have to be is careful to shoot a firearm. They go where you point them. And when I took that deer, there's a processor down in Virginia, and I took that deer to the processor all by myself. I put the deer in the bed, and I still had blood on my boots. And to be able to walk in there and have that deer that I shot myself, and it was funny because there was a kid there, 19 years old or something. I don't think he was older than that. And when I walked in, he was working on this big 8-point buck. And I said, can you take my deer? And he says, yeah, sure. So he walks out with me and I open the tailgate and he looks at this tiny deer in this truck bed. And he says, nice truck. And I'm like, and it is a nice truck. It's an F-250 diesel. It's an awesome truck, but it did take a little bit of the wind out of my sails. And so he picked up this deer effortlessly, and we walked into the processing facility, and he's writing it up. And I couldn't resist. I said, you know, this is the first deer I've ever shot. And here I am, I'm a middle-aged woman, and he's probably shot his first deer when he was three. And he looked at me like I was a curiosity. And I remember he put the pen down and he pointed to the wound on the deer. And he said to me, "You shot it perfect." And it was such a satisfying thing to know that I had stepped up to do this difficult thing and I had done it well. And to this day, if you ask me for a skill that I'm proud of, I mean, I write for a living and I hope on a good day I do it pretty well. But you ask me what I'm proud of, and I can shoot, field dress, and break down a deer.
Yeah. So there's so much more in the book that we don't have time to get to, but I'm wondering if people listening to this, advice to those who would like to add more firsthand food to their diets, what do you tell people?
I think the first thing to do is to be fearless and to not think that you need any special knowledge or any special equipment, is to just dive in and dive into the activity that speaks to you. You know, for me, wild mushrooms were a great place to start. And, you know, there's really no downside when you try these things. If it's a failure, you know, nobody's going to die on the table. As long as you avoid those thin gilled mushrooms. Yeah. There's not a downside. And tap into the community of people who are doing it. You might make new friends along the way, but just jump right in.
Yeah, try it. So this whole idea of getting firsthand food was a bit of a lark in the beginning. And now look how far you've come. So what are your thoughts now looking back?
It was crazy because I had no idea that it was going to be this compelling, interesting thing that it ended up being. And as you say, it started up basically as a lark, you know, a little more, but not much. And that it took hold of me and my husband too. And it became really a part of just what we do, really surprised me. And it made me a big proponent of doing something completely different in middle age. We were in our 40s when we came here. And it's a time when, you know, your physical skills start to be on the decline. And to be in skill acquisition mode, to be in learning mode, instead of being in declining mode, is a great place to be at this age.
Yeah. Tamar Haspel is a columnist for The Washington Post and author of To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. We'll have a link to more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Tamar, thanks so much for the inspiration. I really enjoyed the book.
It was great to talk to you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.